Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Brittany Ann Williams, whose new book is Saint Seducing Metal. We'll also hear from Gordon Nick Mueller, the founding president and CEO emeritus of the National World War II Museum, about his new book, Building the National World War II Museum, written with Callie Martin Schick. Brittany Ann Williams can do anything. She's a classically trained actress who studied musical theater at Howard University, as well as Shakespearean performance at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama in London. She's been a principal vocalist at Hong Kong Disneyland, a theater professor at Coppin University, and you may have seen her work in Queen Sugar and Leverage Redemption. Today we're talking about her new book, Saint Seducing Gold, the second in a series for middle grade readers called The Forge and Fracture Saga. Brittany, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me.
Now bring us up to date on our heroine, Joan Sands. I think one of the challenges of writing a book like this is to make it independent, but still part of a series.
That's very true. I wanted to end book one in a way that felt satisfying, like it had a satisfying conclusion on its own, but still opened the door for the next two sequels. Then you want to do the same thing with book two. It's like, it's the Empire Strikes Back problem.
That's a good problem.
Yeah. So it's where you, like, you have this, it's basically the middle part of this larger story, but it has to exist as its own, like, independent thing.
This book is so much fun. It draws on so much of your theatrical background and the mythology of the Fae. So I wonder if you'd talk about combining those two things.
Yeah, so the initial idea for the series came from this question I asked myself of what would happen if someone with a magical ability to manipulate iron granted by the Orisha Ogun, who's the Orisha of iron technology and war, had to fight against the European Fae because they're vulnerable to iron. And then once that question kind of settled in my brain, it triggered another thought of, well, if I'm going to write about Fae, then I have to include some bits of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And if I include bits of A Midsummer Night's Dream, because I'm a huge Shakespeare nerd and I love Shakespeare as like a spectator and a performer and like a scholar, I was like, there has to be a big battle in the middle of a performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream. So that's what kind of led to Joan being employed by William Shakespeare Acting company, maintaining their swords and choreographing their fights, and her twin brother being an apprentice with the company. But that's what kind of had her be so integrated into the theater. It was kind of marrying all of my loves together.
And your love for history, because there's so many real historical events.
Yeah, it's such a... This is like late 1605 through to 1606 is such like a volatile time. It's really chaotic in English history. And this is also like the time period where William Shakespeare would have written the Scottish play and King Lear. So just kind of diving into those ideas of this being a world that is very aware of magic and witchcraft, especially because King James I was a notorious witch hunter. Like he wrote like books on it. They would bring him to like check people's possessions and tell like if it was authentic or if the person was just faking for attention. Like he was very passionate about finding witches and stomping out magic and all of that.
Now, I know you've planned the entire series, almost finished it, right? But does or did anything surprise you writing this book? Did you surprise yourself?
Yes. So when I sold the series, I had a synopsis of book two and a synopsis of book three all ready to go. But as I sat down to write book two, I just went off the rails to the point where when I looked at my synopsis for book three, the end is intact. Like, the end has stayed the same from like start to finish. But that middle bit, I was like, this is useless now, because it just changed so much from what I thought the story would be. And in really like wonderful and lovely ways, it kind of grew and evolved, and I think is much better than the one that like the newbie writer that was just getting started in publishing imagined the story would be. It's much better now, I think.
One of the things you do so well is depict gender as such a fluid thing. There are very fluid descriptions of attraction, many love stories all throughout this book to think about.
Yeah, and that's really a huge goal of mine with this series, is to show how fluid attraction and relationships and gender have always been, possibly then more so than now. And this is like a time, the early 17th century was a time before we had these labels of like gay or lesbian or bisexual or anything like that. And you would think, because they had anti-sodomy laws on the books, you would think that people would be more restrained in their affections. But King James himself was known to keep attractive young men close to him, be openly affectionate with them. We don't know if this is actually true or a piece of historical propaganda, but it said that he would nibble on the necks of young men in his court meetings. So, and he also like had a wife and they had several children. He very much loved his wife. So you have that like idea of someone who is attracted to people of their own gender and of other genders. Joan herself is someone who's attracted to people of her own gender and other genders. And I really wanted to place queer people firmly in history. Mm-hmm. So I say, like, both in the historical note here and in the historical note in the first book, I say the Fae are made up, but the Black people, the brown people, the queer people are all very real and would have been there in history.
And you feel that in the Sands family, because they're so real and so loving, and the fact that their children have all kinds of desires doesn't seem to bother them in the slightest.
No, they're very chill parents.
And very fierce.
Yes, they are. You often see, in young adult and in like literature for children, you have to kill the parents off usually by necessity. They have to either be dead or be like neglectful, because otherwise you don't get the protagonist can't go off and do these like dangerous, daring things. So the challenge I gave myself was to write active, loving, alive parents and still figure out a way to get Joan into these like exciting, dynamic and often dangerous situations. So it's easier in this book because she's almost immediately pulled away from her family and sent to live at court. Even though Joan is the daughter of a goldsmith, so her family is pretty wealthy for that time period, it's nothing compared to the power of the people who are a part of the royal court.
Now, I'm curious about this one thing, because you write everything so well, but you write love scenes really well, and you write battle scenes really well. And I wonder which you like writing better.
I like the fight scenes better. I like writing the fight scenes. I love reading romantic scenes. But I have always loved like watching fights in movies and on TV and on the stage and learning to do stage combat, like learning to use a sword. One of my favorite parts of grad school was like we got certified in a bunch of different weapons. And so I bring that to the page as I'm like writing the fights. I try to structure the sentences in a way that it controls my reader's breathing so that it feels like you're like you follow the rhythm of the fight, you follow the excitement of the fight. And I try to describe the moves in ways that aren't too pedestrian but are still accessible to people who may have never touched a sword or never been in a fight before in their lives. They're just so fun to me. I mean, that's why I made Joan a sword, like a master swordswoman, because I love swords. I love fights. I love writing fight scenes.
I could feel the rhythm of my reading picking up as we got through fights, which is really interesting. And I want you to talk a little bit about the reaction you got to the first book, since you're now 2/3 of the way through the trilogy.
Yeah, so the reaction has been really great. It's been really wonderful. It's wild to have people tell me that Self-Same Metal is one of their favorite books. I've had people, you know, see me in passing and be like, oh my gosh, you're Brittany Ann Williams. You wrote that Self-Same Metal. Oh my gosh, it's so great to meet you. Like, having that happen has been very strange and wonderful. It just got announced that I'm a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's for LGBTQ plus young adult literature. So that's absolutely amazing, wonderful, exciting. I don't want to say it's been more than I expected, because I had high hopes for myself. I wish I could take these moments and send them back to the me in sixth grade who was made to feel like she was too stupid to ever write a book. And I can't do that literally, but that part, that like hurt part of me that is still kind of being unpacked, I'm sending all of these wonderful moments down to her to kind of keep it moving and to power me through the rest of my hopefully long writing career.
Oh, I hope so. Do you think you'll write for adults?
I have my next like 10 books planned out.
Sure.
Yeah, I do want to stay in the young adult sphere for a little bit longer. And then I have thoughts about where I would branch out into adult literature. But yeah, I would like to somewhere down the line write for adults.
And the other thing about these books is that they're equally appealing for boys and for girls. They're strong in every area in that way, which I think is something that's hard to pull off.
Yeah, I will admit that I write, like, when I write these books, I'm writing to my 16-year-old self. So, like, in that way, I am writing with a female reader in mind. But I do hope that both boys and girls will like it. I do hope that, you know, everyone from, you know, the 12-year-old who wants to read something a little bit older to the adults who love YA will, like, find something in this book to appreciate and to love. Even though, like, I have a 16-year-old Black girl who I am specifically writing to at the core, I find that the more specific you get with your writing, the more universal it ultimately becomes.
So if you would tell us just a little bit about the dedication.
This book is dedicated to my two younger siblings, first. And second, it's dedicated to all of all the Black kids who have had people tell them that they don't belong, or like something that they love is inappropriate for them because they're Black, or that they don't have a place here. Specifically thinking about the way I've been treated in certain classical spaces, particularly with studying and performing Shakespeare, I've been made to feel very unwelcome at times. And it's just to reiterate that I wrote this series to let these kids know that this is a lie. Like, the things these people are telling you, when they tell you you don't belong, when they tell you this thing can't encompass you, it's an absolute lie. And I really hope that in reading this series, kids will, I like to say, I'm giving kids a baseball bat to take to these falsehoods. And I don't want anyone to have to go all the way to adulthood to learn to tune out the noise the way I had to.
You make Shakespeare belong to everyone.
Mm-hmm. And it does.
It's a gift. We've been talking with Brittany Ann Williams, whose new book in the Forge and Fracture series is Saints Seducing Gold. You can meet her Tuesday, April 23rd at 6 p.m. That's Shakespeare's birthday, at Octavia Books. Brittany, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gordon Nick Mueller is the founding president and CEO of the National World War II Museum. He stepped down into semi-retirement in 2017 as president and CEO emeritus, and now researches, writes books, and advises on museum exhibits. Before he began his work at the museum, though, Nick enjoyed a 33-year career as professor of European history here at UNO. In 2019, he published a new book for the 75th anniversary of D-Day called Everything We Have, 6644. And now he's back with a beautiful new book, Building the National World War II Museum, written with Callie Martin Schick. Nick, I'm so happy to welcome you back to talk about this gorgeous book.
Well, I'm always happy to talk on this radio station.
Now, take us back to the original story of the National World War II Museum in fall of 1989, a meeting that I believe involved some cheap sherry, if I'm right.
You got the story right. You know, over the years, I had to include that in the written word because the alcoholic substance changed around depending on who was telling the story. But they said, well, how do you really remember that? And I said, well, because he served the same stuff every time we got together in the afternoons, except when we were at parties when he would. So those afternoon gatherings were cheap Gallo sherry. And he said, I got a big family, so this is cheap stuff, and we can fill up with a lot of ice and have a few more drinks than normal.
Well, he had especially asked to talk to you because he had a new idea.
We cooked up a lot of ideas in either his backyard or mine over the years, and started his D-Day tours to Europe together, started a sailing school, planned camping trips. This is more of a university-related idea, just like the Eisenhower Center was. So anyhow, he just said, I've got an idea. You're head of this new research park. They need university-related projects, and I've got one for you. Let's do a small D-Day museum. I'll give you all my oral histories from the D-Day veterans for the book I'm writing in 4 years, coming out for the 50th anniversary. We can honor Andrew Higgins and do something they won't do in Washington, which is pay tribute to America's contribution to victory in World War II. And I said, it's the best idea you ever had, Steve. Let's do it. We were pretty naive what was ahead of us.
And you knew it would take more money.
He said, oh, great, it's going to only be $1 million. I said, Steve, you're so naive about those things. I'm in administration. I know this is going to cost at least $4 million.
Yeah.
Well, I missed a few zeros. It was 33 years later, it's $400 million.
But, you know, I find it so moving that the museum and all those books had their genesis in simple human conversations.
That's right. That's where a lot of great ideas and great thinking and discoveries happen through research conversations, discussions. It's the way historians do a lot of their work, scientists as well, government people passing, creating legislation. It's the way things get hammered out, I guess you could say. And maybe you could say we made a dent in the zeitgeist here.
Yeah.
I mean, goodness gracious. I mean, if you were thinking about starting a D-Day museum or a World War II museum, the first thing you would have not done is go to the university campus and pick out a couple of historians and say, why don't you guys do this?
And you'd be wrong if you didn't choose them.
I mean, I think it's because it was our idea that we were so invested in it. But still, we had, as you know, lots of ups and downs. We broke a few times. And look, I mean, I was engaged with the research park staff that I had and administrative support. And Steve had a couple of people in the Eisenhower Center. But the museum board was a nonprofit. And it had no staff. So it was all volunteers. That was a crazy thing. The board members were really trying to run this thing. It was about as dumb as Steve and I think, and we could do it. We kept saying, you need to get somebody professional. We can't do this just by ourselves. And, well, that always meant you had to raise money to hire the professionals.
Yeah.
Well, we didn't have that either. So we loaned our staff and supported it. I mean, frankly, this never would have happened without the University of New Orleans.
Well, two things I found really fascinating. I found it was to see the evolution of the master plan in this book unfolding for the reader was really useful and interesting. And finally, that moment when you knew you were going to have the funding for the Canopy of Peace.
That was a big moment.
Well, describe it for us.
First of all, it was controversial about whether we should build it. It was one of the reasons that the Bart Vorzanger won the bid. We loved that presentation so much with that canopy that we just said, he's got this contract. But it was going to be very expensive. And around 2011, we were building other buildings in and near the space where one of the footings, the legs of the canopy had to be built. And the question of putting the pilings in before we even knew we would ever get the funding for it. And the cost was going up from $6 million to $10 million and $12 million, and we hadn't even started yet. So some people thought, well, we needed money more for our exhibits, the Campaigns of Courage. Anyhow, the board voted to go ahead and drive those pilots, even though if we hadn't had a donor, we would have lost money. But in any event, I was calling Boise Bollinger one day, board to tell him, look, we are going up with this other building, and I wanted to say, if we don't have a donor in the next 3 months, we're not going to be able to build that canopy. And he stopped me. He said, stop right there, Nick. And I said, what? He said, I'm about to become your biggest donor.
Wow.
And he knew, and I knew, that our biggest donor was the Boeing Corporation with the $15 billion for the Boeing Center, the U.S. Freedom Pavilion.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a long pause. I was just, you know, gobsmacked. And Boise said, Dick, I said, I'm going to be your biggest donor. I'm going to give you $20 million.
Wow.
And so it was a great day. And we have celebrated that quite often. And when he came in, and it wasn't not a multi-year pledge. Now, he had just sold his company, so he was able to do it. Mm-hmm. He said, I could never have done this a few years ago. But he came up, and we got out Steve Ambrose's old Smith Corona Selectric typewriter. No, that was IBM.
Yeah.
And he typed out that $20 million check in my office on Steve Ambrose's typewriter.
And everything came full circle. I love that story so much.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah, so.
Well, you know, I do think of the museum as the city's biggest literary landmark. I mean.
Well, thank you. I like to think of it that way, too.
You know, it's, out of books grow wonderful things. I mean.
That's right. I don't know if you've been up to see our library on the second floor.
Oh, I would love to see that library. And the bookstore, of course.
The bookstore is downstairs, but the library is is a research library, and it's not generally open to the public, but it is beautiful. And right across the hall or upstairs, we have the high-tech point. We have the studios for distance learning. We're digitizing our entire collection so we can move our resources, our assets, our oral histories, our artifacts, our texts. We can push them all out online or videos. So there's the high tech and the high touch, but the books is where it all started. So I wanted that library to be beautiful. And people go in there and say, well, this could be at Harvard. I said, well, just think of us as a Harvard of the South.
Absolutely. Well, we've been talking with Nick Mueller, who's the president and CEO emeritus of the National World War II Museum. Nick, congratulations on this beautiful book, Building the National World War II Museum, and thank you so much for all you do for our city.
Okay, thank you, Susan. It's been always a joy to talk to you, and today is no exception.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The New Orleans Poetry Festival and Small Press Book Fair wraps up this weekend. Check out nolapoetry.com for the complete schedule. Pamela Abel, a local author and lawyer, will present Long Story Short, Why and How to Write and Market Short Fiction Stories. That's Saturday, April 20th at 9:30 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Friends of the New Orleans Public Library hold a really, really big book sale Saturday, April 20th from 11 a.m. to 3 on the porch of Ladder Library, St. Charles Avenue. Member shopping only from 10 to 11 Saturday morning. Esteban the Green Crayon, star of the best-selling Crayon series, celebrates Earth Day with a special reading of the new book, The Crayons Love Our Planet, Saturday, April 20th from 1:30 to 3:30 at Octavia Books. You're invited to the Emily Henry Extended Universe Library-inspired Lock-In Readathon Funny Story Release Party Extravaganza at Blue Cypress Books. The store will celebrate the release of Emily Henry's new book, Funny Story, April 22nd from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. April 23rd. There will be festivities, libations, games, and trivia, a book swap, late-night bookstore browsing, and so much more. A portion of sales will be donated to Friends of the New Orleans Public Library. Brittany Ann Williams discusses and signs Saint Seducing Metal, Tuesday, April 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Blue Cypress Books hosts a flower drawing workshop and book discussion with Katie Simpson Smith to celebrate the paperback release of her novel, The Weeds, Tuesday, April 23rd at 6:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Errol Labor discusses in Signs When Rex Met Zulu, Tuesday, April 23rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. David Sedaris comes to New Orleans with a new collection of personal essays at the Orpheum Theater. That's April 24th at 7:30. His performance will be followed by a book signing for his new collection, Pretty Ugly. Tickets available at Ticketmaster. Don't miss Poetry and Pie with Nicole Iden, Gina Ferrara, Kyron Pittman, and Andy Young. Thursday, April 25th at 6 at Windowsill Pies on Ferret Street. Roy O'Neill Schmidt and Rosary O'Neill discuss and sign Kate Chopin in New Orleans. Thursday, April 25th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Brendan Wenzel signs his picture book, Two Together. Friday, April 26th at 4:30 at Octavia Books. Congrats to the Humanities Award winners recognized by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities at their annual event April 23rd. They include Gordon Nick Mueller as Champion of Culture, Congo Square Scholar Freddie Williams Evans for lifetime contributions to the humanities, documentary photographer Ben Depp, whose book is Tidelines, Humanities Book of the Year, The Great Power of Small Nations, Indigenous Diplomacy in the Gulf South by Elizabeth Ellis, and Light Up for Literacy volunteer Eat and Read at Melbus with Jane Wolfe. And coming up, the 2024 Walker Percy Weekend takes place June 2nd through 3rd in St. Francisville. Check out walkerpercyweekend.org for complete schedule and tickets. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.